Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to Mother Folklore, the Irish Folk Podcast, brought to you by the Headstuff Podcast Network. Today's episode is brought to you by the letter N, specifically N for Naomi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today is Naomi O'Leary, and we'll be chatting about her excellent podcast, The Irish Passport, about Ireland and the UK's respective relationships with the EU and each other, and the joys of multilingualism. Like so many people who reached adulthood during the bailout, Naomi emigrated from Ireland in search of work opportunities that weren't happening at home. A stint at Reuters in Rome and L'Agence France-Presse. Did I get that right?
More or less. You can call it AFP. Everybody does
AFP
that.
AFP in London.
Yeah.
Established her reputation as a journalist with a talent for making stories about the EU engaging and relatable. As a freelancer, she's written for The Huffington Post, The Atlantic and Politico. In 2016, she produced her own documentary, Granite and Chalk, about all the spies involved in the 1916 rising. Naomi, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
My absolute pleasure. So let's get straight in. The Irish Passport is just an amazing idea for a podcast. And would you like to tell us more about it?
Sure. So the idea is it's your passport to Ireland. So it's Ireland from an international perspective. We want to set things into the context of what's going on internationally and also in Irish history, because what we found was a lot of news about Ireland is for a domestic audience that's quite up to date, and it assumes a lot of prior knowledge and that you know all about the backstory. So certainly for me, I would have to, even myself, like do a fair bit of digging in to actually understand what stuff is really about. Like you might see a name like Morris McCabe, you know, the whistleblower coming up, and it actually takes a bit of work to understand and to kind of like to tune into the conversation at that stage. So basically what we do is we pair the history with the current day and we explain things in terms of, you know, Irish culture and that. So we have we decided to do it because basically it just became hugely politically pressing because of Brexit, because what was happening is that you had this big geopolitical upheaval that, you know, had huge stakes for Ireland. And people just didn't know the basics about Ireland. People didn't know that there was a border in the UK and abroad. And the risk is with a big kind of a dominant culture like the UK culture that's our neighbour, is that that narrative becomes the international narrative. So we felt it was really important to have an Irish voice explaining these things. And also it's not just for people who are listening around the world, but also for people in Ireland. Like we have loads of Irish listeners who appreciate it. Like sometimes we might cover stuff that maybe is all too well known to you, but a lot of people also say like it's great to have kind of a refresher on actually the history that led up to today. And we do a lot of stuff that's fresh and current. So
Stefan, yourself and Tim actually do banter about it really well and actually do make topics that can otherwise be intimidating very accessible.
Ah, thanks. That's nice to hear. Yeah.
And the Irish for passport is pass.
Yeah.
It is indeed. And obviously it's one of the great things, this is a double meaning in Irish because it can also mean a kind of a phase in time or a fit. And we are actually in a very unusual phase of time for passports themselves. And I think the fact that there's the surge in applications for Irish passports is linked to this particular fit in Britain of the aftermath of Brexit itself.
Yeah, what a poetic double meaning, actually. So, yeah, it is a pass in time. So, yeah, that was another one of our topics, was the Brexit Irish. So it was just talking about the huge rise in people who were claiming their Irish identity and claiming Irish passports, and why they're doing it, what it means to them. And it was really interesting to talk to those people, because uniformly they're all trying to embrace Irish history and Irish culture a little bit more than they were before. It was really, really interesting moment, I think, for our country. Yeah,
I think so. And so what would you say were the biggest misconceptions people in Britain and have about around, and also in Europe as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's huge variety. So like just recently I was over in the UK, and I tested this out by getting a gang of girls together and just quizzing them. They're absolute legends for consenting to this, but I quizzed them about Irish history and just asked stuff like, what's the difference between Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and the North of Ireland, like Northern mm-hmm. Ireland? What's the difference? Or, can you name a significant event maybe in, say, Irish history or something?
Yeah.
And then just tease out a little bit what they know. So you have a huge variety. Like one person didn't know that Ireland's independent. That's actually really common in the UK. And there was another person who thought it was the other way around. They thought that Northern Ireland was the bit that was its own country and that the Republic was part of the UK. Hmm. And generally when I got people to guess what date roughly Ireland became independent when they knew, they mostly said about 1850. So they assume if they know that it's independent that it has a much longer history.
Wow.
So there's a very, very deep gap in knowledge about the last 100 years. And that means there's a deep gap in knowledge about Ireland, because how can you understand what's going on and the political currents of today if you don't know that? The UK is almost its own special case there. But like I say, because they have so much clout, mm-hmm. the problem is that viewpoint does get broadcast internationally. And then you have these problems where you have the kind of the UK viewpoint being taken for granted. And
yes. Yeah,
actually, curiously enough, Brexit is kind of changing that in a way, because it forces Ireland onto one side of the negotiating table with the rest of the EU27. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side is the UK. And basically what the Irish government has had to do is make trips to all of the other remaining EU members mm-hmm. and just say, hey, we're Ireland. We have a border. This is our economy. just like the basics. And so now people are much more informed than they were previously. And it's kind of creating a distinction very clearly in people's minds that you can't lump the UK and Ireland in together, which
yes.
very much would have been done before. Yeah,
I think very much so.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I found in terms of, my wife is from Northern Ireland, and one thing that in the most recent election in the UK, people had not heard of the DUP, who have had seats in Westminster for 20 years. I mean, I think the idea that, say, somebody in Ireland wouldn't have heard of a political party who'd been in the Dáil for 20 years just would seem extraordinary to me. There's this strange arm's length relationship with the North that people reflexively accept that it's as part of Britain, but also reflexively think it's very much somewhere else. And anyone who's tried to spend Northern Irish sterling in London has come across this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is fascinating. It's a psychological thing. There's just like a blind spot there. And mm-hmm. What we kind of investigated this actually in our podcast. We compared the way that history is taught in Ireland and the UK, and we basically, well, in England and Wales anyway, we basically found out that Irish history, it's not really taught. Like, you can completely avoid it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to learn it. And so because of the kind of like the complex politics of the 20th century, when Ireland was emerging and it wasn't a republic, and then it was a republic, and the UK wouldn't have been accepting of Irish passports and other stuff, because of all that, there wasn't any one moment when like the UK government would have announced to everybody like, hey, by the way, that part that used to be part of the UK, it's not anymore. So, there's a vagueness that remains mm-hmm. today, yeah, about what the difference is.
That's extraordinary. And so in wider Europe, what do you think the misconceptions about Ireland are, say, in the other countries, like particularly obviously a relationship with Italy especially?
Yeah, definitely. I think something was interestingly highlighted when Leo Varadkar became Taoiseach. Mm-hmm. So you had all these international news organizations saying like, Ireland has, you know, an, a half Indian gay prime minister. Like, well, how bizarre. And obviously it wasn't bizarre. In Ireland, it was like a non-event, you know. So that really shows the perception of Ireland that there is around. Like, we are quite considered a bit of a twee country, very small, probably backward, very Catholic. We're kind of, we had those associations. So people have missed kind of like the last 20 years for sure in Ireland. They didn't see that coming in, you know, the way in which Ireland has changed. So that's something we want to do as well, is just like say loudly, hey, like this is actually what modern Ireland is like. Like this is who we are.
I love that so many news agencies said that Varadkar was our first openly gay Taoiseach. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, you know, like who knows? Like,
exactly. That's not point fingers.
No.
Not saying, yeah. Jack Lynch. Kidding. Yeah. But it's definitely something that when people aren't studying things like that in history class, that it actually weirdly puts a lot of pressure on films made about Ireland and cultural things. I think one of the things, the difference between how people see Washington and how people see Westminster is that we're very familiar with seeing films set in these places. And even though these are both two very dysfunctional political entities at the moment, we're not used to seeing the European Union represented in literature, in film and television. And so we don't have the same relationship with it in our heads.
That's a very interesting point, yeah. There's actually a Dutch TV series that was made recently called Brussels, which is kind of like House of Cards, but in Brussels. And it's really not bad, actually. It's good. It shows it as like this murky center of power with corruption and stuff. But like you say, it actually lets you imagine it, you know, it tells you a story about the people involved and stuff. And you can actually imagine, you know, what is this Brussels? Even though it's not particularly flattering. And the guy who wrote it is actually a pretty harsh Eurosceptic himself. So that's why.
I'm glad you brought up that particular word, because I think, Eurosceptic is such a self-flattering description. It's the most self-flattering political moniker since pro-life, I think.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, why is it skeptic? Do you think a skeptic is someone who actually is taking a balanced or critical, they're kicking the tires of an idea, as opposed to a Europhile who's just, you know, who's blazingly accepting it? Whereas you find in so many debates, Euroskeptics are saying, nah, just not interested. And all they have to do is create a small amount of doubt. And Brexit was won largely by just creating small amounts of doubt, while people who are defending Europe seem to constantly explaining what it is. And even as up to even those few days after Brexit, people were Googling, what is the European Court of Justice? What is the Commission? What does the Commission actually do?
Yeah.
And it's basically a language problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the language that we used is definitely rigged. So I would say like Eurosceptic is an example of that. Like, it is flattering. Like, you'd want to be skeptical, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. You know, you'd want to be skeptical. But also my particular bugbear is austerity. Like, austerity is so flattering for what the policy actually is. Like, austere is like sensible, you know,
yes.
And perhaps you might have an austere aunt who's like clever with her finances, you know? And so it's such a flattering euphemism for cuts. And also it gives it a kind of a sense of rationality that really it didn't have. Like, a lot of economists have huge problems with the whole idea of imposing austerity in a recession. So, you know, it gave it a pass in a way. And this is just totally pervasive throughout language for sure.
I suppose this is one of the things when you're dealing with in translation, I think sometimes translation gives an opportunity to correct something that isn't right. I think there's actually, I think sometimes, and this is one of the big issues with the translation of Brexit itself, that Britain, the Brexit is, implies that Britain's leaving, when we all know it's actually the United Kingdom that's leaving.
True, that's another one. Yeah.
So translation was a nice opportunity to correct that. And I think there's, it'd be nice if we could say, well, austerity is a general idea, is, you know, like the sensible aunt, but then austerity as an actual policy, maybe by translating it, we're saying, actually, no, we don't really think this.
So apparently the Irish word for austerity is gantanus arrogant or anger.
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 I think anger is incredibly appropriate. That's exactly how I feel about it.
Yeah. Or no, sorry. The policy is dania. Yeah. An austerity measure is a Bart dania.
Bart dania.
Okay. Yeah. So there you have it. It's not one that, I mean, do you hear this on TJ Cahir?
I, when, like, I'm, I'm always very interested in how Nuacht works, because that often you find that the people who are translating the news or writing the news in Irish are, have this moment where they have a are writing the first draft of the new terminology in the language. And there's some things, like, say, they don't translate, like they don't translate Black Lives Matter. And we know all about that recently. And
oh,
then,
my God, yeah.
And some people have translated Black Lives Matter without realizing that Dinna Gurum is the Irish for a black person, with Blue Lives Matter being the alleged opposite movement.
Yeah.
But then also the Home Sweet Home, the homeless pro-homeless advocacy movement wasn't translated as Ní HÉin Tintán Mar Shintán Féin, which would have been the equivalent term, because that would have been, first of all, ridiculously long to say in the news.
Yes, it's quite also a mouthful, to be fair. Yeah,
I believe that the professional translators use a term called a proper noun, which are things that aren't translated.
Oh, really? Okay. So, I see. So there's all like an internal policy and debate about which words are translated and that's really interesting.
Especially with the European terminology, because some European terminology, there's a lot of acronyms and people know the acronyms internationally, but then some acronyms are translated and some aren't. So, Naomi, the Irish for the EU is?
Ententes Orpach.
Which is, and acronym-wise?
It's AE, is it? Yeah.
So yeah, you're seeing AE and you're thinking of the famous writer George Russell, obviously, as we all are, but no, AE in this case is actually the EU.
Yeah.
The first ever Dublin Podcast Festival is happening this September 19th to the 30th. Brian Reid from S-Town, My Dad Wrote a Porno, Scroobius Pips, Distraction Pieces, Criminal, The Memory Palace and Welcome to Night Vale are all coming to town. Joining them are great Irish podcasts like Jarlath Regan's An Irishman Abroad, the women's podcast, Dubland, What's the Story Pod with This Feels Terrible. The all-day podcast extravaganza is an all-day event including Fair Game, The Sunday Sermon, Stoneface Film Podcasts, Inside Politics and Potteroony, with wonderful Headstuff Podcast Network pods like Personality Bingo, The Alison Spittle Show, Juvenalia, No Encore, Reviewables and With Relish. That's the 19th to the 30th of September. Definitely an event not to be missed. Tickets are available from Ticketmaster and usual outlets. More information on dublinpodcastfestival.ie and headstuff.org. The Dublin Podcast Festival is brought to you by Headstuff and Aiken Promotions.
So, Naomi, has writing about other European countries change your perception of domestic Irish issues? Often we can be very insular in Ireland and we talk about corruption as if it's the only place in the world where planning applications can be handled in a grubby way or that politicians are making bad decisions.
100%. It's been actually an incredible experience because I got to go to cover elections and politics and so on in all these different countries in Italy and in the UK and stuff. And then I got to go back to Ireland and cover the Irish election and then, you know, do Irish news. And it's amazing. Like we're so harsh on ourselves. We really are. Like there are great things about Ireland. Like we compare really well. Like, of course, we have problems. We do some things well. We do some things badly. But like, if you had to pick problems, Ireland's are actually really not that bad. Like Italy has very, very profound problems with corruption and mafia infiltration that we wouldn't want. But we have a reflexive tendency to catastrophize with when issues come up in Ireland and we say reflexively, this problem exists. We're not fit to be a nation. This actually is, you hear it a lot. Or people say, this would never happen in the UK. You know, we're always comparing ourselves to the UK, which is actually really flattering to the UK because the UK is not this like paradise where things are run all rationally. Like it has that self-image and it's managed to project that image really well, but it's actually not really true. It's not like this centre of rational governance by any means.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we let the Scandinavian countries off the hook enormously as well. We just talk about them as if they're these idyllic kind of middle-class socialist paradises.
Like and in Sweden, you say, you know. So I have this theory about it that like countries have basket case self-images and people have like center of the rational universe self-images. Mm-hmm. So like the UK has center of the rational universe self-image and Italy has basket case. So that actually means there's loads of cultural similarities between Ireland and Italy in the way that we think about ourselves as country. Like people are, they do catastrophize in Italy as well. Like in Italy and Spain, you'll hear people saying phrases like, in a normal country, this would not happen. And when they're talking about normal countries, they mean the Northern European countries, not Ireland. The rational ones, yeah.
That's the thing, because I remember one Brexiteer was referring to the olive line. as being a concept of that basically countries that can't grow olives are well run. And this is obviously this deeply felt issue that Britain has always had with basically with their relationship with Europe. They haven't looked there now.
Yeah.
With kind eyes. It's always been a place they've been fighting.
That's it. Yeah. Like they have a totally different history with Europe than we in Ireland do. Because I mean, culturally, Ireland would have looked towards the centres of Paris and other places in the world, like when we were constructing our national narrative and our literature and all of that. So like we just have a very long history, which is different. And also as a small country, you're forced into a kind of an international awareness that big empires or former empires don't have to do. Mm-hmm. Like you actually, yeah. And then as well, we are so mobile, like we Irish people are all over the world, and that actually feeds back to us as well. Like, because you end up knowing a lot about different parts of the world because you've got, you know, tentacles everywhere.
Because yeah. I remember actually hearing that one of the reasons, particularly during the Bush era, that there was so much anti-French talk. I mean, there was a number of European countries that were criticizing the United States position in Iraq, but I said one of the reasons that there was so much anti-French stuff was that people in the larger cities in New York, Chicago, didn't know any French people, whereas they knew British people, they knew Italian people, they knew a Greek person from a bakery, things like that. And but because it was easy to go after France because people didn't have any relationships because France had very little actual migration to the States.
There you go. That's really interesting. You know, speaking of that, actually, I once lived with a girl who came from a very proud military family from Corsica. Mm-hmm. And she was told quite meanly, I think, by another English guy who was living in the house that there was a nickname for French people, which was cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And she cried. She had no idea that, like, French people were famous for surrendering. This was completely out of her conception. She had no idea.
It's a shocking stereotype that's endured long past its sell-by date. So in terms of going around Europe, how does the Irish language compare to the other little languages, the wee languages?
This is another thing where we're very mean to ourselves. Like, we actually are doing pretty well. I mean, Irish is a minority language, and Europe is actually a continent of minority languages. Mm-hmm. There's huge linguistic diversity. Like, Italy has 30-odd, more than 30 different languages and dialects. And it's a lot of people take issue even with the word dialect, because basically in Italy, they're not variants of standard Italian. They would have been tongues that developed simultaneously from Latin in a different direction.
Yes.
In different parts of Italy. And it was just that the reason why Italian is Italian, it's actually the Tuscan dialect. Mm. And the reason why they picked that one was because of Dante, the works of Dante and Boccaccio, which were quite famous. So it had kind of a prestige when they came to actually make the nation. They chose that one. You know, a lot of those languages will not be mutually intelligible. So they are very different, very diverse. Mm-hmm. And of course, they all have their own literary traditions and all of that. And people are proud of them and all of that. And they have none of the advantages that Irish does. We're mm-hmm. very privileged in that we made the case a long time ago that Irish is a national language.
Yes.
And we won that argument about 100 years ago. So that means that we have all these advantages, like we have official language of the EU status, and mm-hmm. we have state broadcasters and a whole apparatus where people who, if they want to pursue a career in that language, they can.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it gets bashed a lot, but, you know, there are people who are negative about it. But, like, you know, we have a lot going for us, I must say. Yeah.
And so on that note, speaking more languages, we talk about the joys of multilingualism. And
yeah.
You learned Irish in school.
Yeah, I tried to learn Irish in school. I spent more time on that than any other subject. I actually dropped honours maths so that I could spend more time learning Irish for the leaving. But it was like my hardest. I did not struggle with any other subject like I struggled with Irish. I really, and until I went to the Gaeltacht, it was transformative. I spent a few summers in the Gaeltacht, and then suddenly I was like, it's just coming to me, because it was around me. Because you just can't learn it if you're, I don't think I couldn't learn it in a test tube where you're completely isolated from actually hearing it. Like that just didn't, it just didn't work for me. And I didn't realise that I was actually good at languages until I left Ireland and I went to Italy. And then I found out that I learned Italian in a really, really fast amount of time. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's to do with me or it's to do with the language, but I picked it up really fast. And then I was suddenly like, it can be done. You know, it can be done. This is something that we can do. But again, like, you know, we kind of, we're very mean to ourselves and we say, the way that Irish has been taught and all this. But like, one, lots of languages are, and lots of subjects are taught badly. And two, it's probably not to do with Irish or anything specific to us. Mm. It's an Anglophone thing. All Anglophone countries struggle with picking up second languages. And it's because the whole world, the international lingua franca, is English. So you can completely avoid it if you want to. Like, there's no end of material. Whereas if you're living somewhere which has, to begin with, a lingua franca which is not English, then you already are, you're getting both. You're going to get all that English language influence, and you're going to get your own. And that in itself helps you to learn.
So. I think so. I mean, obviously, if you're living in Italy or Belgium, you're getting all your pop culture, pop music especially, through English language. And
yeah, a lot of it. And TV and all the famous people. And so
and even, say, if a French person's hanging out with maybe a Swede, they might actually be speaking English together as a kind of zone. So that is something. But what would you say, is there anything that your experience with learning Italian so quickly could be communicable or transferable to Irish?
Well, I know for sure that immersion helps, like, because I actually had that experience when I went to Connemara and I did the Gaeltacht. I began to pick it up extremely rapidly. More spoken. I mean, that's what worked for me. I don't know what's specific to my experience and what can be generalized. Mm-hmm. I was extremely angry about kind of my experience of learning Irish, because I did try so incredibly hard at it and without payoff. Right. So I have this distinct memory where I was in sixth year, I was about 4 months or so off my leaving, and the teacher walks into the room and she says, "Right, girls, we're going to learn something called the Tishal Ginnadacht." And then I was like, I began to understand what she was telling us. And I was like, "You're telling me that all this time when I was writing essays and they were coming back with these red marks on them, it was because of this thing, but you're only telling me about it now." Like, I was furious, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, there are definite mistakes that are made. And for me, like, what's absolutely crucial is just a sense of joy in the language, a sense of, like, the positiveness to it, you know, and it being like a dull academic thing that you're kind of rote learning in out of a book. It didn't work for me.
Stuff. And finally, before we wrap up, do you have a favourite and a least favourite Irish word?
Well, actually, funny enough, I learned an amazing Irish word from a guy from Canada. Okay. So Canada actually has a really vibrant, like, Irish learning scene. And
Hello to our Canadian listeners, by the way.
Yeah, hi guys. Great to have you with us. He told me a word which is just beautiful. It's a Cuisle Sleibhte. So it means literally the heartbeat of the mountain, but it's a word for like a trickling stream that you can hear, but you can't see.
That's only gorgeous.
Yeah, isn't that lovely?
That's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and there's actually a fair few ugly Irish words, I would say. But yeah, snagkill is a pretty bad one.
Snagkill for jazz.
Yeah, that's...
You know, a woodpecker is a snogdarach.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the connection there? Do you know?
Because I think the snog is the tapping, tapping and the beating.
How interesting.
It doesn't appear to be connected to snog, which is something that a lot of people think it does, but it's I think that's just
It would have to be a particularly aggressive snog, I would have to say.
Exactly.
I wouldn't you wouldn't want a woodpecker snog.
No, certainly not. Naomi, did you know that there are 683 entries in Terma.ie for European Union terminology?
This is probably the extremely hard work of the translators who are working in Brussels. Fair play, guys. Especially if you look at the material they're working with, like, the English of the EU is pretty weird, let alone the Irish.
It is. I think the entire European Union language, the fact that in order to please everyone, they've ended up pleasing no one. And it is a thankless job, but we are going to take a moment to salute their work. And because today's episode is brought to you by the letter N, we are going to look at some N terminology for the European Union.
Yay.
So I'm going to start off. My first one I've chosen is no bailout clause, which is Clausal Tormishka Tarhala.
All right. I am going to tackle this wonderful phrase, I can't even say it in English, nomenclature of territorial units for statistics, which someone has rendered Osgelia into Eichmiu Cove Coton Nunaynad Creta Major Lestadrov.
Beautiful.
Isn't that poetry?
I feel like I'm in a curragh right now, looking at the sun setting over the Aran Islands.
This is what happens when you have a bunch of people from like 28 states and many of them have English as their second language, and they come together and they work out what these extremely complicated things should be. You end up with these tortured phrases.
I think so. I think this is what happens when you let people who enjoy meetings have meetings.
Yeah, true.
And finally, some people at home might be interested to know that the nomenclature of tutorial units for statistics is often called NUTS for short. I am not joking.
Mature humor here.
Areas around Europe have all, each have their own individual nuts code. I swear I'm not making that up. And finally, we are going to look at NEEDS, which is the Network for Enhanced Electoral and Democratic Support, which is Angresan am Takircht de Tokron August and Delahaus.
Well done, Derek.
Thank you very much.
That was exhausting.
And so I want to thank all our friends in the European Union for giving us such beautiful terminology. And I want to thank all the guys and gals in Brussels and the Brussels Gaeltacht translating it and trying to make it slightly more bearable.
Yeah, shout out to the Brussels Gaeltacht.
Shout out to the Brussels Gaeltacht.
They have fun, to be fair. Like, you know, after this, the work is actually done, they get to go into those nice beer cafes and, you know, have the chats together. So, yeah, it's and a great life.
They've earned their chips and mayonnaise.
They have indeed.
So it's a slán from me.
And slán from me. Thanks a lot.
And if you want to follow Naomi on Twitter, her Twitter handle is?
It's Naomi Oh Really, like, oh really.
Good stuff. Slán go fóill. Hi, Dara again. I just want to thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. And I also want to thank all of you out there for listening, subscribing, and giving all the ratings and stuff so far. If you haven't rated or reviewed the show yet on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, please go ahead and do so, because it's a really good way of helping bring the show to new people and new listeners. If there's anything you'd like us to discuss on a forthcoming podcast, please do message us on Twitter at MotherfuckLore, and we will absolutely read them. We will try and get back to as many people as possible, and we'll try to pronounce any words you'd be interested in pronouncing as well. I want to thank Brian for producing the show, and I want to thank Kirsten Scheele for doing the artwork that goes with each podcast. If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, the Headstuff Podcast Network has a range of excellent shows. May I recommend In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, which is a nice short show designed to be heard in the shower about the kind of things you think about in the shower. It's a great show, well worth listening to. That's all for now. See you next time.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Smashing.
Nice.
Excellent.
I had fun.